Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, it's my honor and privilege to inform you that our distinguished speaker is going to be Dr. Ahmad Karimi Hakkak. I don't want to waste any time, therefore I would like to ask Dr. Huma Mahmoudi, our clinical psychologist, wonderful and beautiful, to tell us about Dr. Hakkak. Dr. Mahmoudi.
Good afternoon, dear friends. It's really with great honor and pleasure that I would like to welcome all of you here and to thank the Mehrigan Foundation, specifically Mr. Firouzi, the time witness, how he has worked night and day with a non-existing staff to put this wonderful conference together. And to thank Dr. Holakui for always having wonderful ideas and implementing a great conference for all of us. And I think allowing every one of us to think about the concept of freedom as it applies to our lives and to the world at large. Today, I have the honor of introducing a great friend, a wonderful man, that I have loved and honored for many years. Dr. Karimi Hakkak was born in Mashhad in 1944, and he went through elementary and secondary school in his hometown. He studied classics of Persian literature at an early age with his father. He received his bachelor's degree in English literature in 1966 from the University of Tehran. And then he came to the United States and studied public education administration at the University of Maryland for 2 years and returned to Iran to teach at the University of Tehran. It's interesting, this man has been teaching since he was 20 years old. He taught English at the Air Force Academy when he was just 20 years of age. Then he returned to the United States to continue his studies and received a Master's of Arts degree in English Literature in 1974 and then 2 graduate degrees in Comparative Literature from Rutgers University, which is his MA and his PhD. In the early 1980s, Dr. Karimi Hakkak was a professor of comparative literature at Tehran University. But because of the revolution, he came to the United States. And in 1984, after a year-long lectureship at University of Texas in Austin, he resumed his career at the University of Washington. He's now professor of Persian and Iranian literature, Iranian culture and civilization at the University of Washington in Seattle. I was looking at his resume. It's a book, first of all. He has written many, many pieces of literature. And when you listen to him and you read his work, you find how diverse his work has been. From Machu Picchu to Hawaii to French literature to Arabic to Tajikistan, it's all over the world. Professor Karimi Hakkak has taught comparative literature, literary theory, both in the United States and in Iran. He has won numerous awards and honors, and he's very humble. He hasn't even included half of them in his resume, including a Mellon Professorship at the University of Chicago in 1992 and a Social Science Research Council grant in 1994. He was elected twice in 1998 and 2000 to chair the second and third conferences on Iranian studies. He is the author of 16 books and over 100 articles. In 1996, his monograph, Recasting Persian Poetry, won honorable mention by the prestigious Saidiya Sirjani Book Award Committee. He's a regular contributor to Encyclopedia Britannica and the Encyclopedia Iranica, and has written the essay on the Persian tradition in the Routledge Encyclopedia of Translation Studies. His scholarly works have been translated into Persian, Arabic, and Japanese, as well as Russian, German, and French. In addition to regularly participating in North American-based scholarly organizations, such as the Middle Eastern Association, MESA, and the Society of Iranian Studies, he has presented papers at over 50 international conferences addressing various issues related to Persian literature and Middle Eastern literary traditions, particularly as these relate to the application of literary theory to the national literatures of the Middle East. He is married to Nasrin Khanum Aziz and is the father of Kusha and Kia. I want to tell you that recently he was invited to deliver the prestigious Ehsan Yarshater Literature Series at UCLA. He didn't even include this in his resume. It is a one-week program that only top scholars are invited to give this lectureship. Many of us had the honor of listening to this, to his impeccably well-written and researched work. We were also aware that we were at the presence of an exceptionally unusual and wonderful human being, a self-effacing, talented man of great intellect and sensitivity. It is believed that the greatest form of freedom is freedom from self. And Dr. Karimi Hakak is this person who does not deal with the ego and the self in its negative interpretation of ego and the self, and does not allow the self to interfere with his judgment, thinking, and expression. It is with great pleasure that I'd like to present to you Dr. Ahmad Karimi Hakak.
Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Mahmoudi. When Dr. Holakoui said a clinical psychologist is going to introduce me, my heart sank. Fortunately, she was very merciful. Thank you. I sincerely would like to thank you all for being here. And I think it's my duty, I'm duty-bound to thank all those people who have had anything to do with this gathering. It's a marvelous occasion. And I think I would not be demeaning its content in any way if I say it's a celebration as well. It's a celebration of a community coming to itself. And I think it's a tremendous occasion. Dr. Holakoui, as for years, I've cherished his friendship for the past 33 years. But in recent years, I've heard indirectly, unfortunately, because we do not have the fortune of being able to listen to him over his radio programs. But I think he has been performing a superhuman service to this community, and I think it's wonderful to have him among us. And Mr. and Mrs. Firouzi, who have for the past 3 months been calling me repeatedly, asking me for various things and informing me of various aspects of this gathering, have been wonderful. And but for their persistence, I'm sure some things may have been a little imperfect in this gathering. Fortunately, we've got a man and a woman who are perfectionists by themselves, and therefore they see to it, and they saw to it, that something of that perfectionism is seeps through to this gathering. Mr. Shalchi, who called from the press asking for the spelling of some titles, I appreciate your precision, and thank you for it, Mr. Shalchi. My old friend, the great poet Partho Nuri Ala has been in contact on my part in this gathering. And Dr. Mahmoudi, of course, has been wonderful. I, too, cherish and honor her friendship, and my family and I are blessed by counting her among our friends. Speaking of my family, I was thinking, coming here, that I should finally do what I keep forgetting to do in the everyday routine of my life. And that's thanks to my wife, Natsreen, and my children, Kusha and Kia, who are here. Natsreen has been a marvelous partner in my life, and she has put up with me, my inattention, my goofiness, all kinds of things. Wonderful. My sons are fast emerging as my greatest critics. In fact, Kusha read a draft of what I'm going to present today and made some wonderful suggestions, mainly points of clarification. As someone who works with young people, among them young Iranian Americans, I think one of the greatest things we should be proud of and we can be proud of are the children we are bringing up. And I see it as if in a crystal ball that the generation of our children is going to make its mark in history as a marvel of cross-civilizational achievement. As you know, I've been given the opportunity, and I'm thankful for it, of giving two talks here. This one is in English. Tomorrow at 11:30, there will be one in Persian. The grand scheme and the main theme of the two talks are about the same, although my approach is going to be different. One of the peculiarities that those of us who speak, teach, read, and write in both languages come across is that you have to adopt various languages, various discourses. And I do not mean Persian versus English. There's a language of a scholarship in Persian and another language of a scholarship in English. And I think that's why I've never attempted to translate my own work into Persian, because I think it does not communicate anything except to those who already can read the English. I rather would advocate an approach where versions of our work are then presented according to the universe of discourse in a particular discipline that may be applicable in Iran as in the United States. But that's not my subject. In this talk, I'm going to go about this talk in a rather disciplined way by exposing to you first, opening up my theory and my hypothesis and my methodology, and then making the few points that I am here to make today. Tomorrow, of course, we'll have an opportunity to anchor the same talk in far more evidence in the Persian literature of the past 1100 years, both the classical tradition and the contemporary one. And to drag out of this whole study perhaps a kernel of an idea that I have been toying with for many, many years, and that I have been criticized and attacked very vehemently for. Because people have sensed that in the back of whatever it is that I'm saying this glorious culture needs a very radical rethinking, a very radical reading. Parts of those radical readings have been offered by my colleagues, among whom Farzaneh and Abbas Milani, and I cherish their work for that. Part of it remains to be done, and when all of us are done, and when we leave this world, I think this kind of scholarship is going to reverberate back in Iran and change the attitude and bring about a generation of Iranians that would view their glorious, august literary culture in a very different way. Basically, what I'm saying, and what I'm going to reiterate here today, is that we have fallen under the spell of Persian literature, that we submit to it and to its persuasive power all too uncritically, without asking the right questions and without acknowledging the alterity, the heterogeneity, the otherness of the people who have left that patrimony, that heritage to us. I believe we no longer live in the worlds of Rudaki and Ferdowsi and Hafiz, and much as, of course, we need to read them and honor them and treasure them, we need to realize that they were another, that our duty today dictates that we capture our own world, define our own world, and live in our own world finally, once and forever, and look at Persian tradition, read it in the same way that a scientist looks at a cell under a microscope. I believe we have not done that. I believe all too often we come to Hafiz on our knees, already down. Why? Why do we do that? Why do we accept things like دستی از غیب برون آید و کاری بکند؟ جهان و کار جهان جمله هیچ در هیچ است. Are these the things we live our lives by? And not only do we do that, we go around telling our friends that we actually do augury, open our fortune on the basis of Hafiz's divan. I never do that. I don't believe you do that. I don't believe you go out buying and selling stock on the basis of the poem that you opened on the page the evening before. Why we do that, it beats me. Some things become cliché. We keep repeating them and leave an image of ourselves in our host cultures that really does not jibe with reality. My basic point is going to be, we need to nurture more rational, critical thinking in our culture. The theory I'm going to base my talk today, brief as it has to be, is basically that there is such a thing as culture. And yet, culture too is a dynamic, ever-changing entity. Not only that culture has subspecies. And two of those subspecies are political culture and aesthetic culture. And once we approach these categories in this way, and once we read our literature, or offer a reading of our literature, or a rereading of our literature, that leads us to the aesthetic culture that is the basis for it, and once we transpose and transfer that energy from the aesthetic culture to the political culture, we will then come up with a kernel of some truth. We will begin to understand our political behavior. Politics is rooted in political culture, in other words, just as literature is rooted in aesthetic culture. Our behavior on the political scene cannot be imagined to be totally divorced and isolated from our behavior in the literary scene. After all, political culture is that system which gives us our way of behaving in politics. Whether we vote or not, whether we join political parties or not, whether we demonstrate for or against this particular state, whether we actively participate in political processes, whether we want, as we seem to have wanted all through the 20th century, a huge government to solve all of our problems, some say to kill all of our enemies, eradicate them, or whether we begin to behave otherwise, I submit to you today that there are pieces of knowledge that we can get from our beautiful literary tradition that are relevant to that behavior. That being my theory, I then say, well, we certainly have a lot to be proud of. And other speakers have touched on those too. And I can only detail them on that. But the fact is that, as they too have mentioned, for over 150 years, people have been trying to bring about political freedom but have not been that successful. Of course, the political culture has changed just as the general culture has changed, in the same way that I do not behave the same way towards my wife, and I do not view her in the same light as my great-great-grandfather may have viewed his wife. In fact, sometimes I tell my students, go ahead, present three slices of Iranian society to me, 1900, 1950, 2000. A lot has changed. Not even an Ayatollah Khomeini, with that huge mandate of the revolution on his shoulders, could say, okay, women cannot vote. We have crossed that milestone. Not even with all the efforts of the early years of the revolution were Iranian women cowed into becoming good mothers and good mothers only. So there's a lot of change. There's a lot of positive change. Why is it then that all these this collective effort to bring about political freedom does not seem to have borne fruit? I submit to you that it is because, number one, we don't see the changes that have been brought about. And number two, because we, in a way, preach one thing and practice another. We do not put our money or our feet where our mouth is. We express the desire to achieve political freedom, but we are not willing to pay the price. That is basically the theory I'm going to base my talk today. My hypothesis is that we have established institutions that are supposed or were supposed to bring about political freedom. We do have a parliament. We do have courts. We do have the separation of powers. Where have things gone wrong so that that institutionalization has not led to concrete steps towards achieving and expanding political freedoms, the political realm? And I submit to you, it is because every one of us like aspects of authoritarianism, that we enjoy exercising authority over our children, that as men, many of us enjoy exercising authority, what authority patriarchy makes available to us, over our women, that we do not really, 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 really appreciate otherness. We pay lip service to religious diversity. We pay lip service to linguistic diversity. But what does it actually mean to say that Turkish Iranians and Persian Iranians are both Iranians of equal rights? Which one of us is willing to even say, even if Iran gets divided, it is more important for that Turkish-speaking Iranian to get his freedom? Of course, we'll try not to let that happen, because the integrity of the country is at stake, and we'll try to assure and ensure as many rights for them within a, if necessary, a federated system whereby their linguistic and cultural otherness is fully acknowledged and celebrated. I know some of what I'm going to say is not going to sit well with some people, yet hear it from me. Now, finally, it is my assumption, of course, that in our glorious classical literature, while the ideal of freedom is there, it is not the kind of freedom we seek. That in this literature, as in our society today, and much more so in the past than today, we value stratification. We value hierarchy. We go through gestures of superiority and submission. We go through gestures of who is better than whom and why. And those things, I submit to you, are maybe old, outdated norms, social norms that we need to leave behind. Now, we do have things to celebrate. Look at you. Look at this gathering. The organizers of this conference have doubtless sensed the urgency of putting the issue of freedom, and not necessarily political freedom, but let's say spiritual freedom, mental freedom, freedom of worship, freedom of work, freedom of play, on the agenda. So, there's hope. There's a lot of hope. What we need to do is to keep doing this in a sustained way for a long period of time. Change in social, in the social scene, in the social sphere, may not be as slow as geological change, but it certainly is not as fast as personal human changes on my face and yours. And as such, we need to learn to be patient and to persevere. In this, I'm going to take a page from the history of freedom in the West. We see this freedom, and of course American society is a kind of artificial society. It did not proceed from the very beginning. It left off where the British tradition of the 16th and 17th centuries had left off. And so we see in this Western, shall we say, tradition, the march of freedom that has gone on for centuries. And it is there because every generation contributes to it by resisting or by ascending, by giving consent or by denying consent to the rulers. I arrived in this country when the Vietnam War was going on, and I saw the undoing of Nixon, thank God. And I saw the March for Civil Liberties, that wonderful, beautiful movement these days we hear about because it's commemorating Martin Luther King in ways. And so, I think we need to pause, give ourselves credit, and continue our march with vigilance, under the watchful eyes of our children's children, and encourage them to proceed. I think in a generation we are going to have a wonderful representation here in this country that views Iran not in terms of the rulers of the time, but in terms of the old country, transcending us and our political baggage for or against this or that state. States come and go. They are transient. Cultures are what we need to pay attention to. And I would like to submit to you that the whole course of Iranian modernization gives us real cause for pride, not hollow, boastful pride. But it tells us that in areas where we have been able to modernize more or less completely, it has taken the patience of generations to go through the modeling activity, to look around, to look at the Paris of the 1870s and 80s and 90s, to look at the French Revolution and see what kernel of idea can be transplanted into Iranian society of the time. That, after all, is what brought the culture of the constitutional movement to Iran. As a result, I would like to argue that appropriation and indigenization, that is, making things native and appropriating. Read Sayyid Fakhruddin Shadman's book, Taskhir Tamaddun Gharbi, or Taskhir Tamaddun Farangi. It's a wonderful thesis. It says, we conquered this. We are so great that we did conquer these elements from the West. Once we start to change this mental pattern into what we indeed, not any single individual, but we as generation after generation of Iranians have done, that really becomes cause for our pride. I would like to argue with you that by the time that changed into the model of Gharb Zadegi, or being struck by the West, we went into a defeatist mode, which we still are, into a mode of withdrawal, into a mode of somehow running after some notion of purity in our own culture that never was there. It never was. Neither during the Sasanian, nor during the Islamic period, nor even definitely during the Safavid and on. But of course, there were periods when efforts, great efforts, were made. And I'm going to speak to you about that. So, given those strategies of presentation, my talk is going to be historical and comparatist. I'm going to make analogies with Western countries, Europe and the United States, And I'm going to move you through stages of history. Let me begin this way. The relations of power and authority, observable in Persian poetry and prose, both classical and contemporary, are not conducive to the nurturing of the notion of freedom as we understand it or ought to understand it. Nixon is going to China. Myself, a professional student of literature, is going to tell you something is wrong with our literature. Except that I'm not going to invite you not to read it, because that would be the best way of submitting to it. I'm going to ask you to give yourself agency and make you determine what Hafez means to you. Do not allow that man, because he's a devil in language. He can govern your mind so easily. Liberate yourself from the discourse of Persian literature and then look at him and say, I accept this line and this image, and I do not accept this and that image. After all, that kind of dialogue has been going on in Persian literature for so many generations. When in a Rubai attributed to Khayyam we hear, ای کاش پس از هزار سال از دل خاک چون سبز امید بردمیدن بودی. And in a غزل by Rumi we hear, کدام دانه فرو رفت در زمین که نرست، چرا به دانه ی انسانت این گمان باشد. We are already observing a dialogue, a debate. The image of a seed planted in the soil and the likelihood or unlikelihood of its growth, or whether this is a good analogy for life after death, becomes the bone of contention. We have lost those bones of contention. We no longer question our classics as much as we should.